He continued his search for information on Nadia, and what implications this might have for his son. But that was insane. He was burying his head in the sand. Despite Grana's warning, he kept surfing and soon came upon the name of a professor of neurology, an expert on savant syndrome, named Charles Edelman. Instead of reading on as he normally would, Baldur always preferred the written to the spoken word, he called the switchboard at the Karolinska Institute. He soon realized how late it was. Edelman was unlikely to be at work still, and his home number was not on the website. But wait a moment. He was also the head of Ekliden, an institution for autistic children with special abilities. Baldur tried calling there. The telephone rang a number of times before a woman answered and introduced herself as Nurse Lindros.
"I'm sorry to disturb you so late in the evening," Baldur said. "I'm looking for Professor Edelman. Might he possibly still be there?"
"Yes, in fact he is. No one is setting off for home in this dreadful weather. Who may I say is calling?"
"Franz Baldur," he said.
And in case it might help, he added,
"Professor Franz Baldur."
"Just a moment," Nurse Lindros said. "I'll see if he's available."
Baldur stared down at August, who was once again gripping his pencil hesitantly, and that worried him somehow, as if it were an ominous sign.
"A criminal organization," he muttered again.
"Charles Edelman," a voice said. "Am I really talking to Professor Baldur?"
"The very same. I have a little—"
"You can't know what an honour this is," Edelman said. "I'm just back from a conference at Stanford, where we discussed your work on neural networks. In fact, we were even asking ourselves if we neurologists don't have a great deal to learn about the brain through the back door, as it were, through AI research. We were wondering—"
"I'm flattered," Baldur interrupted, "but right now, I have a quick question for you."
"Oh, really? Is it something to do with your research?"
"Not at all. I have an autistic son. He's 8 years old and hasn't yet said a single word. But the other day we passed a traffic light on Hornsgatan, and afterwards—"
"Yes?"
"He just sat down and drew it at lightning speed. Completely perfectly. It was astonishing."
"And you want me to come and take a look at what he's done?"
"I'd like that, but that's not why I called. The fact is that I'm worried. I've read that perhaps drawing is the way in which he interacts with the world around him, and that he might lose this ability if he learns to talk."
"I can tell you've been reading about Nadia."
"How do you know that?"
"Because she's always mentioned in this context. But may I call you Franz?"
"Of course."
"Excellent, Franz, and I'm so glad you called. I can tell you straight away that you have nothing to worry about. On the contrary, Nadia is the exception that proves the rule, no more than that. All research shows that speech development actually enhances savant abilities. It can happen, of course, that children lose those skills, but that is mostly due to other factors. They get bored, or there's a significant event in their lives. You probably read that Nadia lost her mother."
"I did."
"Maybe that was the reason, even though neither I nor anyone else can know for sure. But there's virtually no other documented case of a similar evolution, and I'm not just saying this off the top of my head, or because it happens to be my own hypothesis. There is broad consensus today to the effect that savants have everything to gain from developing their intellectual skills on all levels."
"Do you mean that?"
"Yes, definitely."
"He's also good at numbers."
"Really?" Edelman said thoughtfully.
"Why do you say that?"
"Because it is extremely rare for artistic ability to be combined with mathematical talent in a savant. These two different skills have nothing in common, and sometimes they seem even to block each other."
"But that's how it is with my son. There's a kind of geometric precision about his drawings, as if he had worked out the exact proportions."
"How fascinating. When can I see him?"
"I don't know. For the time being, I only wanted some advice."
"In that case, my advice is clear. Make an effort with the boy. Stimulate him. Let him develop his skills in every way."
"I—"
Baldur felt a strange pressure in his chest and found it hard to get the words out.
"I want to thank you," he said. "Really, thank you. Now, I have to—"
"It's been such an honour to talk to you. It would be wonderful to be able to meet you and your son. I've developed quite a sophisticated test for savants, if I may boast a little. I could help you to get to know the boy better."
"Yes, of course, that would be terrific. But now I must—"
Baldur mumbled, without knowing what he wanted to say.
"Goodbye, and thank you."
"Oh, my pleasure. I hope to hear from you again soon."
Baldur hung up and sat still for a moment.
His hands crossed over his chest, and looked at his son. August was still looking at the burning candle, the yellow pencil in his hand. A shudder went across Balder's shoulders, and the tears came. Whatever else you might say about Professor Balder, he was not one to cry easily. In fact, he could not remember when it had last happened. Not when his mother died, and definitely not when watching or reading anything. He thought of himself as a block of stone. But now, in front of his son, with his rows of pencils and crayons, the professor cried like a child, and he just let it happen. It had been Charles Edelman's words. August would be able to learn to speak and could keep drawing, and that was overwhelming news. But Balder was not crying just because of that. There was also the drama at Solifon, the death threat, the secrets he was privy to, and the longing for Hannah or Farah or anyone who could fill the gap in his heart.
"My little boy," he said,
so emotional he failed to notice his laptop switch itself on and show pictures from one of the surveillance cameras outside the house. Out in the garden, in the blustering storm, there was a tall, thin man in a padded leather jacket, with a grey cap pulled down to conceal his face. Whoever it was knew that he was being filmed, and even if he seemed lean and agile, there was something in his swaying walk which was reminiscent of a heavyweight boxer on his way into the ring. Grana was sitting in her office at Seppo, searching the web and the agency's records. She did not really know what she was looking for, but something worrying was gnawing away at her. Her conversation with Balder had been interrupted by Helena Kraft, chief of Seppo, who was looking for her again to discuss the same matter as before. Then Ilona Casales at the NSA had called to continue their conversation. This time she sounded calmer, and again a little flirtatious.
"Have you managed to sort out your computers?" Grana said.
"Yes, that was a circus, but I don't think it's anything serious. I'm sorry if I was a little cryptic last time. I don't have much of a choice. I just want to stress again that the level of threat against Professor Balder is both real and serious, even though we know nothing for certain. Did you have time to deal with it?"
"I've spoken to him. He refuses to leave his house, told me he was in the middle of something. I'm going to arrange protection."
"Fine. As you might have guessed, I've done more than quickly check you out. I'm very impressed, Miss Grana. Shouldn't someone like you be working for Goldman Sachs and earning millions?"
"Not my style."
"Not mine either. I wouldn't say no to the money, but this underpaid snooping is more my thing. Now, honey, here's the situation. As far as my colleagues are concerned, this isn't a big deal, which I happen to disagree with, and not just because I'm convinced that this group represents a threat to our national economic interests. I also think there are political implications. One of those Russian computer engineers I mentioned, a guy called Anatoly Chabarov, is also linked to Ivan Gribanov, a member of the Russian Duma. He's notorious, and a major shareholder in Gazprom."
"I understand.
But most of it so far is just dead ends. I've spent a lot of time trying to crack the identity of the person at the top.
The man they call Thanos.
Or woman."
"Woman?
I could be wrong. This type of group tends to exploit women, not promote them to leadership positions, and this figure has mostly been referred to as a he."
"Then what makes you think it might be a woman?"
"A sort of reverence, you could say. They talk about Thanos in the same way men through the ages have spoken about women they desire.
A beauty, in other words."
"Right. But maybe I'm just picking up some homoeroticism. Nothing would make me happier than if Russian gangsters and bigwigs were to indulge more in that department."
"Ha, true. In fact, I mention it only so that you'll keep an open mind if this mess ends up on your desk.
You understand there are also quite a few lawyers mixed up in it."
"What else is new, right? Hackers steal and lawyers legitimize the theft."
"True. Baldur said to me that we're equal before the law if we pay the same amount. If you can afford a strong defense, you can get away with whatever you want these days. You do know who Baldur's legal opponents are, don't you? The Washington firm Dackstone and Partner."
"Sure. In that case, you know that the firm is also used by large tech companies to sue the shit out of inventors and innovators, hoping to get some modest reward for their creations."
"I discovered that when we were dealing with the lawsuits of that inventor, Håkan Lance."
"Grim, wasn't it? But the interesting thing is that Dackstone crops up in one of the few conversations we've managed to track down and decrypt from this criminal network, although there the firm is simply referred to as DP, or even D. So Solifon and these crooks have the same lawyers?
It looks like it. And that's not all. Dagstone is about to open an office in Stockholm. Do you know how we found that out?
No, said Grana, who was beginning to feel stressed. She wanted to finish the conversation and ensure that Balder got police protection.
Through our surveillance of this group, Casalis went on, Anatoly Chavarov mentions it in passing, which suggests that there are ties to the firm. They knew about the office opening even before it became public. Also, Dagstone and partner is setting up in Stockholm together with a Swedish lawyer named Brodin. He used to be a criminal lawyer, and if you remember, he was known for getting a little too cozy with his clients. I do remember that classic picture in the evening papers. Kenny Brodin out on the town with some gangsters, his hands all over some call girl, Grana said. I saw that. I'd bet Mr. Brodin is a good place to start if you want to check out this story. Who knows? Maybe he's the link between big business and this group.
I'll take a look at it, Grana said. But right now I've got a number of other things to deal with. I'm sure we'll be in touch again soon.
She called the duty officer for Seppo's personal protection unit, who that evening was none other than Stig Uttergren. Her heart sank. Uttergren was 60, overweight, known to be a heavy drinker, and most of all, he liked to play cards online. He was sometimes called Officer No Can Do. She proceeded to explain the situation in her most authoritative tone, and demanded that Professor Franz Balder in Saltschubaden be given a bodyguard as quickly as possible. As usual, Uttergren responded by saying that it would be extremely difficult, perhaps not possible at all. When she countered by saying that this was an order from the chief of Seppo herself, he muttered something which might even have been, "That stroppy cunt."
"I didn't hear that," Grana said. "Just make sure this is put in place immediately," which, of course, it was not.
While she was waiting and drumming her fingers on her desk, she searched for information on Dagstone and partner, and anything else she could find linked to what Casalis had been telling her. And that is when she was overcome by a sense of something horribly familiar. She could not put her finger on it. Before she could find what she was looking for, Uttergren called back to say that no one from personal protection was available. There was an unusual amount of activity for the royal family that evening, he said, some sort of public engagement with the Norwegian crown prince and princess, and the leader of the Swedish Democrats had had an ice cream thrown at his head before his guards could intervene, which meant that they had to provide reinforcements for his late speech in Södertälje. So Uttergren had sent out two great guys from the regular police, Peter Blom and Dan Flink, and Grana had to make do with that, even if their names reminded her of Kling and Klang in Pippi Longstocking. For a moment she had serious misgivings. Then she got angry with herself. It was so typical of her snobbish background to judge people by their names. She might have had more cause for concern if they had a posh name like Jullentofts or something, and been irresponsible layabouts.
"I'm sure this'll be fine," she thought.
She got back to work. It was going to be a long night.
Chapter 9 November 20th to 21st Night. Salander woke up, lying straight across the king-sized bed, and realized that she had been dreaming about her father. A feeling of menace swept over her like a cloak. But then she remembered the start of the evening, and concluded that it could as easily be a chemical reaction in her body. She had a terrible hangover. She got up on wobbly legs and went into the large bathroom, with the jacuzzi and the marble and all the idiotic luxuries, to be sick. But nothing happened. She just sank to the floor, breathing heavily. Then she stood up and looked at herself in the mirror, which was not particularly encouraging either. Her eyes were red. On the other hand, it was not long after midnight. She must have slept for only a few hours. She took a glass from the bathroom cupboard and filled it with water. But at the same moment, the details of her dream came flooding back, and she crushed the glass in her hand. Blood dripped to the floor, and she swore, and realized that she was unlikely to be going back to sleep. Should she try to crack the encrypted NSA file she had downloaded? No, that would be pointless. At least for now. Instead, she wound a towel around her hand and took from her bookshelves a new study by Princeton physicist Julie Tammet, which described how a big star collapses into a black hole. She lay down on the sofa by the windows overlooking Slusen and Riddarfjärden. As she began to read, she felt a little better. Blood from the towel did seep onto the pages,
and her head would not stop hurting, but she became more and more engrossed in the book, every now and then making a note in the margin. None of it was new to her. She knew better than most that a star stays alive as a result of two opposing actions, the fusion at its core forcing it outwards, and the gravitational pull keeping it together. She saw it as a balancing act, a tug of war from which a victor eventually emerges, once the fuel for the reactions runs out and the explosions weaken. When gravity gains the upper hand, the celestial body shrinks like a punctured balloon and becomes smaller and smaller. In this way a star can vanish into nothing. Salander liked black holes. She felt an affinity to them. Yet, like Julie Tammet, she was not interested in black holes per se, but rather in the process which creates them. Salander was convinced that, if only she could describe that process, she would be able to draw together the two irreconcilable languages of the universe, quantum physics and the theory of relativity. But it was no doubt beyond her capabilities, just like the bloody encryption, and inevitably she began again to think about her father. When she was a child, that revolting specimen had raped her mother over and over again, right up until the time her mother received injuries from which she would never recover. Salander herself, then 12, hit back with a horrific force. At the time she could have no idea that her father was an important spy who had defected from the GRU, the Soviet Military Intelligence Service, nor could she know that a special department within the Swedish security police, referred to as the Section, was protecting him at any cost. Yet even then she understood that there was some mystery surrounding the man, a darkness no one was allowed to approach in any way. That even applied to so simple a thing as his name, Zala, or Alexander Zalachenko, to be more precise. Other fathers could be reported to the social services and the police, but Zala had forces behind him which were above all that. It was this, and one other thing which for her were true black holes. The alarm went off at 1:18 a.m., and Balder woke with a start. Was there someone in the house? He felt an inexplicable fear and reached across the bed. August was lying beside him. The boy must have crept in as usual, and now he whimpered with worry, as if the wailing of the siren had made its way into his dreams. My little boy, Balder thought. Then he stiffened. Were those footsteps? No, he must be imagining things. All you could hear was the alarm. He cast a worried look towards the storm beyond the windows. It seemed to have grown worse. The sea was beating against the jetty and the shore. The window panes shook and arched. Could the alarm have been set off by a gust of wind? Perhaps it was as simple as that. He still had to check to see if that protection Gabriele Grana was organizing had arrived at last. Two men from the regular police were supposed to have been there hours ago. It was a farce. They had been delayed by the storm and by a series of conflicting orders. It was either one thing or another, and he agreed with Grana, it seemed hopelessly incompetent. He would have to deal with that in due course. Now he had to make a call. But August was beginning to wake up, and a hysterical child banging his body against the headboard was the last thing Balder needed right now. The earplugs, it occurred to him, those old green earplugs he had bought at Frankfurt Airport. He took them from the bedside table and gently pushed them into his son's ears. Then he tucked him in and kissed him on the cheek and stroked his curly, tousled hair, straightened the collar on the boy's pyjamas, and made sure that his head was resting comfortably on the pillow. Balder was frightened, and should have been in a hurry, or had every reason to be, yet he took his time and fussed over his son. Perhaps it was a sentimental moment in the midst of a crisis, or he wanted to put off confronting whatever awaited him out there. For a moment he wished he did have a weapon, not that he would have known how to use it. He was a programmer, for heaven's sake, who had developed some paternal instinct in his old age, that was all. He should never have gotten into this mess. To hell with Solifon and the NSA and all criminal gangs. But now he had to get a grip. With stealthy, uncertain steps he went into the hallway. And before doing anything else, before even looking out at the road, he turned off the alarm. The racket had set his nerves on edge, and in the sudden silence which followed, he stood stock still. Then his mobile rang, and even though it startled him, he was grateful for the distraction. "Yes?" he said. "Hello, this is Jonas Anderberry.
I'm on duty tonight at Milton Security. Is everything all right?
What? Well, I think so.
My alarm went off. I know that, and according to our instructions, when this happens, you're supposed to go down to a special room in the cellar and lock the door. Are you down there?
Yes,
he lied. Good, very good. Do you know what's happened?
No idea.
The alarm woke me up. I have no clue what set it off. Could it have been the storm? Unlikely. One moment, please.
Anderbury's voice sounded a bit unfocused.
What is it?
Balder said nervously.
It seems... For God's sake, tell me what's going on. Sorry, just take it easy, take it easy. I'm going through the picture sequence from your cameras, and it does look as if...
As if what?
As if you've got a visitor. A man. Well, you can see for yourself later. A lanky man with dark glasses and a cap has been prowling around your property. He's been there twice, as far as I can see. But, as I said, I've only just noticed it now. I'd have to look at it more closely to be able to say more.
What sort of person is it?
Well, it's hard to say.
Anderbury seemed to be studying the picture sequences again.
But maybe... I don't know. No, it's too soon to be speculating, he said.
Go on, please go on. I need something specific. It will make me feel better.
Okay. In that case, there's at least one reassuring thing I can tell you.
And what's that?
His walk. The man walks like a junkie. Like a guy who's just taken a load of speed. There's something cocky and stilted about the way he moves, and that could be a sign that he's just an ordinary druggie and petty thief. On the other hand...
Yes?
He's done a very good job of hiding his face, and then...
Anderbury fell silent again.
Keep going!
One moment.
You're making me nervous, you know that?
Don't mean to, but you know...
Balder froze. The sound of a car engine could be heard from his garage drive.
You're getting a visitor.
What shall I do?
Stay where you are.
Okay,
said Balder, more or less paralyzed. But he was not where Anderbury thought he was. When the telephone rang at 1:58, Blomqvist was still awake. But his mobile was in the pocket of his jeans on the floor, and he did not manage to answer it in time. In any case, the call was from a withheld number, so he swore and crawled back into bed and closed his eyes. He could really do without another sleepless night. Ever since Berrier had fallen asleep a little before midnight, he'd been tossing and turning and thinking about his life. Not much of it felt right. Not even his relationship with Berrier. He had loved her for many years, and there was every reason to think that she felt the same way about him, but it was no longer as simple as it had once been. Perhaps Blomqvist had started to feel some sympathy for Gregor. Gregor Beckmann was Erika's husband. An artist, and he could not be accused of being grudging or small-minded. On the contrary, when Gregor had realized that Erika would never get over Blomqvist, or even be able to stop herself from tearing his clothes off, he had not lost his temper. He had made a deal. You can be with him, just so long as you always come back to me. And that's how it became. They set up an unconventional arrangement with Berrier, mostly sleeping at home with her husband in Solchelbaden, but sometimes here with Blomqvist on Bellmansgarten. Over the years, Blomqvist had thought that it really was an ideal solution, one which many couples who lived under the dictatorship of monogamy ought to have adopted. Every time Berrier said, "I love my husband more when I can also be with you," or when at some cocktail party Beckmann put his arm around him in a brotherly embrace, Blomqvist had thanked his lucky stars for the arrangement. Yet he had lately begun to have doubts, perhaps because he had had more time to think. And it had occurred to him that an agreement is not necessarily always agreeable to all. On the contrary, one party might advance their self-interest under the guise of a common decision, and in the long run it often becomes clear that someone is suffering, despite assurances to the contrary. Maria's call to her husband that evening evidently had not been well received. Who knows? Maybe Beckmann was also lying awake right now. Blomqvist tried to put it out of his mind. For a little while he even tried daydreaming. But that did not help much, and in the end he got up, determined to do something more useful. Why not do some reading on industrial espionage, or, better still, sketch out an alternative funding plan for Millennium? He got dressed, sat down at his computer, and checked his inbox. Most of it was rubbish, as usual, even if some of the emails did give him a bit of a boost. There were shouts of encouragement from Malm and Ericsson.
also from Andre Zander and Harriet Wanger, in the light of the coming battle with Cerna, and he answered them with more of a fighting spirit than he actually felt. After that, he checked Salander's document, without expecting to find anything there. But then he lit up. She had answered. For the first time in ages, she had given a sign of life. Baldur's intelligence isn't in the least bit artificial. How's your own these days? And what happens, Blomqvist, if we create a machine which is a little bit cleverer than we are? Blomqvist smiled and thought of the last time they had met at Café Bar on St. Paulsgatan. It took a while before he noticed that her message contained two questions, the first one a friendly little jibe which perhaps regrettably contained a grain of truth. What he had written in the magazine lately had lacked intelligence and genuine newsworthiness. Like so many journalists, he had just been plugging away, occasionally trotting out clichés. But that's how it was, for the moment, and he was much keener to ponder Salander's second question, her riddle, not so much because, in itself, it interested him especially, but because he wanted to think of some clever response. "If we create a machine that is cleverer than we ourselves are," he thought, "what happens then?" He went to the kitchen, opened a bottle of Ramlösa mineral water, and sat at the kitchen table. Downstairs, Fru Jerna was coughing rather painfully, and in the distance, amid the hubbub of the city, an ambulance wailed away in the storm. "Well," he mused, "then we get a machine that can do all the clever things which we ourselves can do, plus a little bit more. For example—" he laughed out loud and understood the point of the question. "A machine like that could go on to produce something more intelligent than itself in turn, and then what happens? The same would be true of the next machine, and the next one, and the next one, and soon the very source of it all, man himself, would be no more interesting to the latest computer than a lab rat. An explosion of intelligence beyond all control, as in the Matrix films." Blomqvist smiled and went back to his computer and wrote, "If we create such a machine, then we'll get a world where not even Lisbeth is so cocksure." After that he sat looking out through the window, insofar as one could see anything beyond the swirling snow. Every now and then he looked through the open door at Barrier, who was sleeping soundly, and who knew nothing about machines more intelligent than human beings, or at least was not concerned about that right now. He thought he heard his mobile give a ping, and sure enough he had a new voicemail. That worried him. He was not sure why. Apart from ex-girlfriends, who call when they're drunk and want to have sex, you usually only get bad news at night. The voice in the message sounded harried.
"My name is Franz Baldur. I know it's rude to call this late. I apologize for that. But my situation has become somewhat critical, at least that's how I see it. I've just discovered that you were looking for me, which is really a strange coincidence. There are a few things I've been wanting to tell you about for some time now. I think they might interest you. I'd be grateful if you could get in touch as soon as possible. I have a feeling that this might be a bit urgent."
Baldur left a telephone number and an email address, and Blomqvist jotted them down and sat still for a while, drumming his fingers on the kitchen table. And then he dialed the number. Baldur was lying in bed, agitated and scared, yet he was feeling a little calmer now. The car coming up his drive had been the police guard arriving at long last. Two men in their 40s, one tall and one quite short, both looking cocky and with the same short, trendy haircut. But they were perfectly polite and apologized for the delay in taking up their post.
"Milton Security and Gabriele Grana at the security police briefed us on the situation," one said.
They were aware that a man wearing a cap and dark glasses had been snooping around the property, and that they had to be on their guard. Therefore they turned down the offer of a cup of hot tea in the kitchen. They wanted to check out the house, and Baldur thought that sounded sensible. Otherwise they did not make a hugely positive impression, but then he did not get an overwhelmingly negative impression either. He had taken their telephone numbers and gone back to bed to join August, who was still sleeping, curled up with his green earplugs. But Baldur had not been able to fall asleep again. He was listening for noises out there in the storm, and eventually he sat up in bed. He had to do something, or he would go mad. He checked his mobile. He had two messages from Linus Brandel, who sounded bad-tempered and defensive all at the same time. At first Baldur felt like hanging up, but then he caught a couple of things which were interesting after all. Linus had spoken to Mikael Blomqvist at Millennium Magazine, and now Blomqvist wanted to get in touch, and Balder began to think. "Mikael Blomqvist," he muttered. "Is he to be my link with the outside world?" Balder knew very little about Swedish journalists, but he did know who Blomqvist was, and was aware of his reputation as someone who always went right to the heart of his stories, never yielding to pressure. That in itself did not necessarily make him the right man for the job. Plus, somehow, Balder seemed to recall hearing other, less flattering things. So he called Gabriella Grana again. She knew just about everything there was to know about the media scene, and had said that she would be staying up late. "Hello?" she answered right away. "I was about to get in touch. I'm looking at that man on the CCTV. We really ought to move you now, you know."
"But, my God, Gabriella, the police are here. Finally, they're sitting right outside the front door."
"There's nothing to suggest that the man will come through the front door."
"Why would he come back at all? The man from Milton said he looked like an old junkie."
"I'm not so sure about that. He was carrying some sort of box, something technical. We should play this safe."
Balder glanced at August, lying next to him.
"I'm quite happy to move tomorrow. That might help my nerves. But I'm not going anywhere tonight. Your policemen seem professional, professional enough, at any rate."
"If you're going to be stubborn, I'll see to it that Flink and Blom make themselves conspicuous and cover the entire property."
"Fine, but that's not why I'm calling. You said I ought to go public, remember?"
"Well, yes. That's not the kind of advice you would expect from the security police, is it? I still think it would be a good idea, but first I'd like you to tell us what you know. I'm feeling a little apprehensive about this story."
"In that case, let's talk tomorrow morning, when we've had a good sleep. But one thing, what do you think of Mikael Blomqvist at Millennium? Could he be the right sort of person to talk to?"
Grana gave a laugh. "If you want my colleagues to have an apoplectic fit, then definitely talk to him."
"Is it as bad as that?"
"At Seppo, people avoid him like the plague. If you find Blomqvist on your doorstep, then you know your whole year is shot, they say. Everybody here, including Helena Kraft, would advise against it in the strongest terms."
"But it's you I'm asking."
"Well, my answer is that your reasoning is sound. He's a damn fine journalist."
"Hasn't he also come in for some criticism?"
"For sure. People have been saying that he's past his prime and that his writing isn't positive or upbeat enough or whatever. But he's an old-fashioned investigative reporter of the highest caliber. Do you have his contact details?"
"My ex-assistant gave them to me."
"Good. Great. But before you get in touch with him, you must first tell us what you have. Do you promise?"
"I promise, Gabriella. Now I'm going to sleep for a few hours."
"Do that. And I'll keep in touch with Flink and Blom and arrange a safe house for you first thing in the morning."
After he had hung up, he tried again to get some sleep. But it proved as impossible this time as before. The storm made him increasingly restless and worried. It felt as if something evil was travelling across the sea towards him, and he could not help listening anxiously for any unusual sounds. It was true that he had promised Grana he would talk to her first, but he could not wait. Everything he had kept bottled up for so long was throbbing to get out. He knew it was irrational. Nothing could be that urgent. It was the middle of the night, and regardless of what Grana had said, he was by any reckoning safer than he had been for a long time. He had police protection and a first-rate security system, but that did not help. He was agitated, and so he got out the number Linus had given him and dialed it, but of course Blomqvist did not answer. Why would he? It was far too late. Balder left a voice message instead in a slightly forced, whispered voice so as not to wake August. Then he got up and put on his bedside light. On the bookshelf by the bed there was some literature which had nothing to do with his work, and both absent-minded and worried, he flicked through an old novel by Stephen King, Pet Cemetery. But that made him think even more about evil figures travelling through the night. For a long time he just stood there with a book in his hand. Then he felt a stab of apprehension, which he might have dismissed as nonsense in broad daylight, but which now seemed totally plausible. He had a sudden urge to speak to Farah, or better still, Stephen Warburton at the Machine Intelligence Research Institute in Los Angeles, who would be certain to be awake, and while imagining all sorts of unpleasant scenarios, he looked out to sea and the night and the clouds scudding across the sky. At that moment his mobile rang, as if it had heard his prayer, but it was neither Farah nor Warburton.
"My name is Mikael Blomqvist," the voice said. "You've been looking for me." Correct. I'm sorry to have called so late.
No problem. I was awake anyway.
Can you talk now?
Absolutely. I was actually just answering a message from a person whom I think we both know. Lisbeth Salander.
Who?
Sorry, maybe I've gotten hold of the wrong end of the stick. I thought you had hired her to go through your computers and trace a suspected data breach.
Balder laughed.
Yes, my God, she's a strange girl, that one, he said. She never revealed her surname, even though we had a lot of contact for a while. I assume she had her reasons, and I never pushed her. I met her at one of my lectures at the Royal Institute of Technology. I'll be happy to tell you about it. It was pretty astonishing. But what I meant to ask was, well, you'll probably think it's a crazy idea.
Sometimes I like crazy ideas.
You wouldn't feel like coming over right now. It would mean a lot to me. I'm sitting on a story which I think could be explosive. I'll pay for your taxi here and back.
Thanks, but I always pick up my own tab.
Tell me, why do we have to talk now, in the middle of the night?
Because, Balder hesitated,
because I have a feeling this is urgent. Or actually, it's more than a feeling. I've just been told that I'm under threat. And an hour or so ago, someone was snooping around my property. I'm frightened, to be honest. But I want to get this information off my chest. I no longer want to be the only one in the know.
Okay.
Okay, what?
I'll come. If I can manage to get hold of a taxi.
Balder gave him the address and hung up, then called Professor Warburton in Los Angeles, and had an intense conversation with him on an encrypted line for about 30 minutes. Then he put on a pair of jeans and a black cashmere polo, and went in search of a bottle of Amarone, in case that was the kind of thing Blomqvist might enjoy. But he got no further than the doorway before he started in fright. He thought he had seen a movement, something flashing past, and looked anxiously towards the jetty and the sea. But it was the same desolate, storm-lashed scene as before, and he dismissed whatever it was as a figment of his imagination, a product of his nervous frame of mind, or at least he tried to. He left the bedroom and walked along the large window on his way towards the upper floor. Suddenly gripped by a new fear, he spun around again, and this time he really did glimpse something over by the house next door. A figure was racing along in the shelter of the trees. And even if Balder did not see the person for more than a matter of seconds, he could make out that it was a powerfully built man with a backpack and dark clothes. The man ran in a crouch, and something about the way he moved had a trained look to it, as if he had run like that many times before, perhaps in a distant war. It took a few moments for Balder to fumble for his mobile, and he tried to work out which of the numbers on his call list belonged to the policemen out there. He had not put their names into his contacts, and now was uncertain. With a shaking hand he tried one which he thought was right. No one answered, not at first. The ringtone sounded 3, 4, 5 times before a voice panted out,
"Blom here! What's up?" "I saw a man running along the line of trees by my neighbour's house. I don't know where he is now, but he could very well be up by the road near you."
"Okay. We'll check it out."
"He seemed..." Balder said.
"What?"
"I don't know. Quick."
Dan Flink and Peter Blom were sitting in the police car chatting about their young colleague, Anna Berzelius, and the size of her bum. Both had recently gotten divorced. Their divorces had been painful at first. They both had young children, wives who felt let down, and parents-in-law who, to varying degrees, called them irresponsible shits. But once the dust had settled and they had gotten shared custody of the children, and new, if modest, homes, they had both been struck by the same realization, that they missed their bachelor days. Lately, during the weeks when they were not looking after the kids, they had lived it up as never before. Afterwards, just like when they were in their teens, they had discussed all the parties in detail, especially the women they had met, reviewing their physiques from top to bottom and their prowess in bed. But on this occasion they had not had time to discuss Anna Berzelius in as much depth as they would have liked. Blom's mobile phone rang, and they both jumped, partly because he had changed his ringtone to an extreme version of satisfaction, but mainly because the night and the storm and the emptiness out here had made them edgy. Besides, Blom had his telephone in his pocket, and since his trousers were tight, his waistline had expanded as a result of all the partying, it took a while before he could get it out. When he hung up, he looked worried.
"What's that about?" Flink said.
"Balder saw a man. A quick bastard, apparently."
"Where?"
down by the trees next to the neighbour's house. The guy's probably on his way up towards us.
Blom and Flink stepped out of the car. They'd been outside many times over the course of this long night, but this was the first time they shivered right down to the bone. For an instant they just stood, looking awkwardly to the right and the left, shocked by the cold. Then Blom, the taller of the two, took command and told Flink to stay up by the road while he himself went down towards the water. It was a short slope, which extended along a wooden fence and a small avenue of newly planted trees. A lot of snow had fallen. It was slippery, and at the bottom lay the sea. Bergensfjorden, Blom thought. And in fact he was surprised that the water had not frozen over, but that may have been because of the waves. Blom cursed at the storm and at this night duty which wore him out and ruined his beauty sleep. He tried to do his job all the same, not with his whole heart, perhaps, but still. He listened and looked around, and at first he could not pick out anything. It was dark. Only the light from a single lamppost shone into the property, immediately in front of the jetty. So he went down toward it, past a garden chair which had been flung about in the storm. In the next moment he could see Balder through the large window pane. Balder was standing some way inside the house, bent over a large bed, his body in a tensed position. Perhaps he was straightening the covers. It was hard to tell. He seemed busy with some small detail in the bed. Blom should not be bothering about it. He was meant to be keeping watch over the property, yet there was something in Balder's body language which fascinated him, and for a second or two he lost his concentration, before he was brought back to reality again. He had a chilling feeling that someone was watching him, and he spun around, his eyes searching wildly. He saw nothing, not at first, and had just begun to calm down when he became aware of two things, a sudden movement by the shiny steel bins next to the fence, and the sound of a car up by the road. The engine stopped, and a car door was opened. Neither occurrence was noteworthy in itself. There could easily be an animal by the trash bins, and cars could come or go here even late at night, yet Blom's body stiffened, and for a moment he just stood there, not knowing how to react. Then Flink's voice could be heard.
"Someone's coming!"
Blom did not move. He felt that he was being observed, and almost unconsciously he fingered the service weapon at his hip, and thought of his mother and his ex-wife and his children, as if something serious really was about to happen. Flink shouted again, now with a desperate tone in his voice.
"Police! Stop right there!"
And Blom ran up towards the road, although it did not seem the obvious option even then. He could not rid himself of the apprehension that he was leaving something threatening and unpleasant down by the steel bins. But if his partner shouted like that, he did not have a choice, did he? And he felt secretly relieved. He had been more frightened than he cared to admit, and so he hurried off and came stumbling onto the road. Up ahead, Flink was chasing after an unsteady man with a broad back and clothes that were far too thin. Even though he hardly fit the description of a quick bastard, Blom ran after him. Soon afterwards they brought him down by the side of the ditch, right next to a couple of mailboxes and a small lantern which cast a pale light over the whole scene.
"Who the hell are you?"
Flink bellowed with surprising aggression. He had also been scared, and the men looked at them in confusion and terror. He was not wearing a hat. He had hoarfrost in his hair and in the stubble on his chin, and you could tell that he was cold and in pretty bad shape. But above all there was something extraordinarily familiar about his face. For a few seconds, Blom thought that they had arrested a known and wanted criminal, and he swelled with pride. Balder had gone back to the bedroom and tucked August in again, perhaps to hide him under the blanket if anything should happen. Then he had a crazy thought, prompted by the sense of foreboding he felt, accentuated by his conversation with Warburton. Probably his mind was just clouded by panic and fear. He realized it was not a new idea, but something which had been developing in his subconscious during many sleepless nights in California, so he got out his laptop, his own little supercomputer, connected to a series of other machines for sufficient capacity, opened the AI program to which he had dedicated his life, and then he deleted the file and all of the backup. He barely thought it through. He was like an evil god snuffing out a life, and perhaps that was exactly what he was doing. Nobody knew, not even he himself, and he sat there for a little while, wondering if he would be floored by remorse and regret. It was incomprehensible, wasn't it? His life's work was gone with just a few taps of a key. But oddly enough it made him calmer, as if at least one aspect of his life was protected. He got to his feet and once more looked out into the night and the storm. Then the telephone rang. It was Flink, the second policeman.
"I just wanted to say that we apprehended the man you saw," the policeman said. "In other words, you can relax. We have the situation under control."
"Who is it?" Balder said.
"I couldn't say. He's very drunk, and we have to get him to quiet down. I just wanted to let you know. We'll get back to you."
Baldo put the mobile down on the bedside table, next to his laptop, and tried to congratulate himself. Now the man was under arrest, and his research would not fall into the wrong hands. Yet he was not reassured. At first he did not understand why. Then it hit him. The man who had run along the trees had been anything but drunk. It took a full minute or more before Blom realized that they had not in fact arrested a notorious criminal, but rather the actor Lasse Westman, who did often enough play bandits and hitmen on screen, but who was not actually wanted for any crime. The realization did not make Blom feel any calmer, not just because he again suspected it had been a mistake to leave the area by the trees and the bins, but because this whole episode could lead to scandal and headlines in the press. He knew enough about Westman to be aware that whatever that man did all too often ended up in the evening papers, and you could not say that the actor was looking particularly happy. He puffed and swore as he scrambled to get to his feet, and Blom tried to work out what on earth the man was doing out here in the middle of the night.
"Do you live in the area?" he said.
"I don't have to tell you a fucking thing,"
Westman hissed, and Blom turned to Flink in an attempt to understand how the whole drama had begun. But Flink was already standing a little way off, talking into his telephone, apparently with Balder. He probably wanted to show how efficient he was by passing on the news that they had seized the suspect, if indeed he was the suspect.
"Have you been snooping around Professor Balder's property?"
Blom said.
"Didn't you hear what I said? I'm not telling you a fucking thing. What the hell? Here I am, strolling around perfectly peacefully, and along comes that maniac waving his pistol. It's outrageous. Don't you know who I am?"
"I know who you are, and if we've overreacted, then I apologize. I'm sure we'll have a chance to talk about it again. But right now we're in the middle of a tense situation, and I demand that you tell me at once what brought you here to Professor Balder."
"Oh, no, don't you try to run away now."
Westman was probably not trying to escape at all. He was just having trouble keeping his balance. Then he cleared his throat rather dramatically and spat right out into the air. The phlegm did not get far, but flew back like a projectile and froze to ice on his cheek.
"Do you know something?"
he said, wiping his face.
"No. I'm not the bad guy in this story."
Blom looked nervously down towards the water and the avenue of trees, and wondered yet again what he had seen there. Still he remained standing where he was, paralyzed by the absurdity of the situation.
"Well then, who is?"
"Balder."
"How so?"
"He's taken my girlfriend's son."
"Why would he have done that?"
"You shouldn't bloody well be asking me. Ask the computer genius in there. That bastard has absolutely no right to him,"
Westman said, and fumbled in the inside pocket of his coat.
"He doesn't have a child in the house, if that's what you think,"
Blom said.
"He sure as hell does."
"Really?"
"Really."
"So you thought you'd come along here in the middle of the night, pissed as a newt, and fetch the child?"
Blom said, and he was about to make another crushing comment when he was interrupted by a sound, a soft, clinking sound coming up from the water's edge.
"What was that?"
he said.
"What was what?"
answered Flink, who was standing next to him and did not seem to have heard anything at all. It was true that the sound had not been all that loud, at least not up here. Yet it still made Blom shudder. He was just about to go down to investigate when he hesitated again. As he looked around anxiously, he could hear another car approaching. It was a taxi, which drove past and stopped at Balder's front door, and that gave Blom an excuse to stay up on the road. While the driver and the passenger settled up, he cast yet another worried look down to the water. He thought he heard another sound. That didn't reassure him. He did not know for sure, and now the car door opened and a man climbed out whom Blom, after a moment's confusion, identified as the journalist Mikael Blomqvist. Though God only knew why the hell all these celebrities had to congregate right here in the middle of the night.
Chapter 10 November 21st Early Morning Balder was standing in the bedroom next to his computer and his mobile, looking at August, who was whimpering restlessly in the bed. He wondered what the boy was dreaming. Was it about a world which he could even understand? Balder wanted to know. He wanted to start living, to no longer bury himself in quantum algorithms and source codes and paranoia. He wanted to be happy, not tormented by that constant weight in his body. He wanted instead to launch himself into something wild and magnificent, a romance, even. For a few intense seconds he thought about the women who had fascinated him, Gabriella, Farah, and others too. He also thought about the woman who it turned out was called Salander. He had been spellbound by her, and as he now remembered her, he saw something new in her, something both familiar and strange. She reminded him of August. That was absurd, of course. August was a small, autistic boy. Salander was not that old either, and there may have been something boyish about her, but otherwise she was his polar opposite. Dressed in black, a bit of a punk, totally uncompromising, still it occurred to him now that her eyes had that same strange shine as August's, when he had been staring at the traffic light on Hornsgatan. Balder had encountered Salander at the Royal Institute of Technology in Stockholm, while he was giving a lecture on technical singularity, the hypothetical state when computers become more intelligent than the human being. He had just begun by explaining the concept of singularity in terms of mathematics and physics when the door opened and a skinny girl in black strode into the lecture hall. His first thought was that it was a shame there was no other place for junkies to go. Then he wondered if the girl really was an addict. She did not seem strung out, but on the other hand, she did look tired and surly, and did not appear to be paying any attention to his lecture. She just sat there, slouched over a desk. Eventually, in the middle of a discussion of the moment of singularity in complex mathematical calculation, the point where the solution hits infinity, he asked her straight out what she thought of it all. It was mean of him to pick on her. But what had happened? The girl looked up and said that instead of bandying fuzzy concepts about, he should become skeptical when the basis for his calculations fell apart. It was not some sort of real-world physical collapse, more a sign that his own mathematics were not up to scratch, and therefore it was sheer populism on his part to mystify singularities in black holes when it was so obvious that the main problem was the absence of a quantum mechanical method for calculating gravity. With icy clarity, which set off a buzz in the hall, she then presented a sweeping critique of the singularity theorists he had quoted, and he was incapable of coming up with any answer other than a dismayed, "Who the hell are you?" That was their first contact. The girl was to surprise him a few times more after that. With lightning speed, or just one bright glance, she immediately grasped what he was working on. When he realized that his technology had been stolen, he had asked for her help. And that had created a bond between them. They shared a secret. Now he was standing there in the bedroom thinking of her, but his thoughts were interrupted. He was overcome by a new, chilling sense of unease, and he looked through the doorway towards the large window overlooking the water. In front of it stood a tall figure in dark clothes and a tight black cap, with a small lamp on his forehead. He was doing something to the window. He pulled across it with a swift and powerful movement, like an artist starting work on a fresh canvas, and before Balder even had time to cry out, the whole window fell in, and the figure moved towards him. Jan Holzer usually told people that he worked on industrial security issues. In fact, he was a former Soviet Special Forces soldier who spent his time breaking into security systems. He had a small, skilled staff, and for operations like this one, as a rule, the preparations were so painstaking that the risks were not as great as one might imagine. It's true that he was no longer a young man, but for 51 he kept himself in good shape, with hard training, and was known for his efficiency and ability to improvise. If fresh circumstances cropped up, he thought about them and took them into consideration in his planning. His experience tended to make up for his lack of youthful vigour, and occasionally, in the limited circle within which he could talk openly, he would speak of a sort of sixth sense, an acquired instinct.
He had learned over the years when to wait and when to strike, but although he had been through a bad patch a couple of years earlier and betrayed signs of weakness, humanity, his daughter would say, he now felt more accomplished than ever before. He was once more able to take pleasure in his work, that old sense of excitement. Yes, he did still dose himself with 10 milligrams of Stesolid before a mission, but that was only because it enhanced his accuracy with weapons. He remained crystal clear and alert at critical moments, and most important, he always carried out the tasks he was assigned. Holzer was not someone who let people down or bailed out. That was how he thought of himself. And yet, tonight, even though his client had stressed that the job was urgent, he had considered calling it off. The bad weather was a factor, but the storm in itself would never have been enough to get him to consider cancelling. He was Russian and a soldier, who had fought in far worse conditions than these. He hated people who moaned about trivial things. What bothered him was the police guard, which had appeared out of nowhere. He did not think much of the policemen on the property. From his hiding place he had seen them snooping around with the vague reluctance of small boys told to go outside in bad weather. They would rather have stayed sitting in their car talking rubbish, and they were easily frightened, especially the taller of the two, who seemed to dislike the dark and the storm and the black water. As he stood there, staring from among the trees a little while ago, he had appeared terrified, presumably because he had sensed Holzer's presence, but that was not something that worried Holzer. He could have slit the man's throat swiftly and soundlessly. Still, the policemen were not good news. Their presence considerably raised the level of risk. Above all, it was an indication that some part of the plan had leaked out. There was a heightened readiness. Maybe the professor had started to talk, in which case the operation would be meaningless. It might even make their situation worse. Holzer was determined not to expose his client to any unnecessary risks. He regarded that as one of his strengths. He also saw the bigger picture, and despite his profession, he was often the one who counseled caution. He had lost count of the number of criminal gangs in his home country that had gone under because they had resorted too often to violence. Violence can command respect. Violence can silence and intimidate and ward off risks and threats, but violence can also cause chaos and a whole chain of unwanted consequences. All those thoughts had gone through his mind as he sat hidden behind the trees and the line of bins. For a few seconds he was resolved to abort the operation and go back to his hotel room, yet that did not happen. A car arrived, occupying the policeman's attention, and he spotted an opportunity. Without stopping to evaluate his motivations, he fitted the elastic of the lamp over his head. He got out the diamond saw from his left-hand jacket pocket and drew his weapon, a 1911 R1 carry with a custom-made silencer, and weighed them, one in each hand. Then, as ever, he said, "Thy will be done. Amen." Yet he could not shake off the uncertainty. Was this right? He would have to act with lightning speed. True, he knew the house inside out, and Yuri had been here twice and hacked the alarm system. Plus, the policemen were hopeless amateurs. Even if he were delayed in there, say the professor did not have his computer next to his bed, as everyone had said, and they had time to come to his aid, Holzer would be able to dispose of them, too, without any problem. He looked forward to it. He therefore muttered a second time, "Thy will be done. Amen." Then he disengaged the safety on his weapon and moved rapidly to the large window overlooking the water. It may have been due to the uncertainty of the situation, but he felt an unusually strong reaction when he saw Balder standing there in the bedroom, engrossed in something. He tried to persuade himself that everything was fine. The target was clearly visible, yet he still felt apprehensive. Should he call the job off? He did not. Instead, he tensed the muscles in his right arm and with all his strength drew the diamond saw across the window and pushed. The window collapsed with a disturbing crash, and he rushed in and raised his weapon at Balder, who was staring hard at him, waving his hand as though in a desperate greeting. The professor began to say something confused and ceremonious, which sounded like a prayer, a litany, but instead of God or Jesus, Holzer heard the word disabled. That was all he managed to catch, and in any case it did not matter. People had said all sorts of things to him. He showed no mercy. Quickly and almost soundlessly the figure moved through the hallway into the bedroom.
in that time Balder registered with surprise that the alarm had not gone off, and noticed a motif of a grey spider on the man's